Some folks will join us. So, good morning, everybody. I have a couple articles today for our journal club, our February journal club. I always have that moment of panic that did I do the right articles? So, I appreciated, Henry, your comment about these are the January articles for the February journal club.
Yeah, and sometimes I forget to
Very
do that
helpful.
because I just forward the list, you know, and so I will try to remember to do that. And I
It's
did hope that it wasn't too many emails in people's inboxes, but
No, it's very helpful. So I have a couple of articles. I actually had to pare it down. I ended up at first I was like with six or seven I wanted to talk about, but I didn't think we'd have the time. So I pared it down to four. We've got two tumor articles and then two non-neoplastic articles. And I'm hoping the first two will generate some discussion and perhaps the third one and the fourth one is more, let's look at this wonderful paper that Andy Cherg put out. So I'm going to start out with a paper looking at the reproducibility on invasion in small pulmonary adenocarcinomas, according to the WHO, and a modified classification. And I know this is a topic that comes up time and time again, but I think this paper was actually very well thought out and very well put together. So this came from our colleagues in the UK, and essentially, what they're looking at is the age-old problem, right? The lack of reproducibility amongst pulmonary pathologists for invasion versus not invasion, right? So, as we all know, current WHO looks at invasion as a marker for the T staging, and you know this, of course, has clinical implications, right? So, you know, the current threshold for adjuvant chemotherapy in N0 cases is about 4 centimeters, and then adjuvant osimertinib is 3 centimeters, and that may go down in the future, just depending on how the clinical trials go, you know, thus highlighting the importance of our accurate T staging, right, which is based off of the invasion. And of course, we do extremely poorly in these measures. You know, there was a study in 2012 by the IASLC, and then another study in 2023. There's been tons of studies, and we've talked about many of them here. So, you know, what this paper starts off talking about, they spend a lot of time. I'm actually going to bring up, so I've got the paper up here. Hopefully, everybody can see it. I want to bring up there. Oh, we want to make this scrolling. They have this little this picture that they have here, which I thought was very interesting. Looking at grapes, you know, we always, you know, long looking at grapes and shriveled collapse of the grapes and how that causes infolding. And they essentially have this hypothesis that if we can just educate people more about the iatrogenic effects of collapse, that then perhaps we would be able to increase our reproducibility. And so that's kind of how they approached this paper, is they wanted to increase reproducibility, and they're also approaching it from the standpoint that we overdiagnose invasion and we underdiagnose non-invasive things, adenocarcinoma in situ. And you know, kind of an interesting thing I wanted to point out, even in this first figure, what they show is iatrogenic collapse, and they show three pictures here that they claim should all be called adenocarcinoma in situ because of tangential cutting, something iatrogenic collapse leading to something we would call papillary versus acinar, and then they say all of these should be adenocarcinoma in situ. I mean, hopefully you could see this figure up here. I'm not totally convinced, honestly, even just from this figure, which is fine. But right out of the gate, I'm a little concerned that some of the photos of things that they're calling AIS, I wouldn't necessarily call AIS, but I think that's what we're here. That's what we're here to discuss. So essentially, what they did with this paper, they had a number of pathologists, quite a few, 42 pathologists from 13 different countries. So one thing that they pointed out in their discussion is many of the reproducibility papers are at one institution or two institutions, and they're not looking at a broad range of people. So they had 42 different pathologists from numerous countries, which I thought was interesting and different from some of the other papers that we've seen on this. And they essentially trained them. So they gave them the set of cases. All right. So let's see how many cases they had, a number of cases that they pulled. And they gave the cases to the pathologist and said, you know, grade them, right? Tell us the amount of invasion, things like that. And only about half showed concordance, right? Which is kind of like what we would expect. And the other half showed some form of disagreement amongst the pathologists as to what constitutes invasion and what doesn't. And then what they did is they put them through this training. And I had to dig to find the supplemental data on how they trained them. So And I uploaded this in the Dropbox. So if you're interested in this topic and wanted to look at it further, it might be worth a look. But I brought it up here because I was trying to figure out, well, what exactly are they training them on? What are they saying is invasion versus not invasion? And so they talked about iatrogenic collapse. They talked about using special stains to look, at the elastic fibers to see is it there, what qualifies as papillary, what qualifies as not papillary, what qualifies as entrapped acinar and things like that. And then they had a whole bunch of data looking at two-dimensional representations. The statistics in this paper were quite, there was a lot. It was quite impressive. So, if I look at their photos here, again, they have their lovely little grape example, which I think is actually kind of nice. But if you look here, I agree with these photos. I really do. Talking about the collapsed areas versus the not collapsed areas, and I understand the tangential sectioning, although this isn't an area that I wouldn't necessarily have called adenocarcinoma in situ like in their original figure, but totally support that concept of tangential sectioning. And one thing I wanted to ask later when, in our discussion is how many people use special stains to look at elastin to try to decide if there's true collapse versus not. But if you look through this, and I'm not going to go through all of the details, but I'm not so certain that I agree with all of the photos. This one in particular kind of struck me as it seems like they're trying to show this as an example of adenocarcinoma in situ, and I'm not sure that I would feel that it was, but then I don't necessarily run elastin stains, and so maybe I have been, overcalling collapsed lipidic as papillary. So, I think it's important to be open to changes in your practice. So they trained the pathologists, showing all of these different things. They talked about what constitutes true papillary, what constitutes true solid, what constitutes true micropapillary. Although, again, if you look at the micropapillary photo, and I hope this projects well, there are some things in here that I 100% would call micropapillary, and they are saying that it is not. So I don't know. So I'll leave that to discussion if you agree. Well, that's not micropapillary. And then they talk a couple of times about what they consider morphologic invasion versus a accepted surrogate marker for morphologic invasion. And again, I think there's definitely room for discussion in that. Claiming that acinar is not morphologic invasion, but I feel fundamentally it is. But anyway, so certainly some interesting thoughts on how they trained the pathologist. So after they did this training, and they mention in their in the paper that they stress to the pathologist that do not worry about underdiagnosing invasion. Our goal here is to get you to recognize the lack of invasion, right? Which I think is a little counterintuitive for the real world because anyways, but I'll wait for the discussion. But that is stressed here multiple times. And then what they did is they trained them, and the amount of in situ went up after the training. And then they actually did then a third round of assessments, and they used a number of different studies on this third round. So they actually looked at biomarker analysis, okay, and they looked at molecular. So they did molecular on all the cases, and they grouped them. And then they also looked at long-term clinical outcomes. Did they have recurrence, right? And so, of course, they're going to have a cohort. They discovered a cohort of patients that were had no recurrence after a certain amount of time, and their molecular and their biomarkers, everything came back as most likely to be in situ versus not in situ in a cohort that was called invasive. However, there is still a small percentage of patients that did recur that were called in situ. So a comment they talk about in the discussion, which I thought was very interesting, is there is a concern amongst pathologists, and I think this is very reasonable, worrying about if you call something non-invasive, if you say this is a adenocarcinoma in situ, and then the patient recurs, based off of the literature, you really shouldn't recur after surgical resection if something is truly adenocarcinoma in situ. And so then the question opens you up. They actually mentioned, like, could you be sued? Like, could there be associated litigation with this? And I thought that was kind of interesting. They talk a lot about pathologist feelings in this paper, which I don't say that as a criticism. I think it's actually kind of interesting. Shared feeling of uncertainty, reflection after you get clinical data in the background, which of course you don't get. When you have, you don't, you're not going to get long-term follow-up when you're making that original diagnosis. They talked about a couple of things that I don't do standard and is not standard in the WHO, including using TP50, TP53 to corroborate with if you have that abnormality, it would support progression from insight to early invasive. I don't use P53 in my standard, and then also using proliferative index. And again, I don't use proliferative index, and it's not part of our current grading criteria, but I thought that was very interesting. I thought that the genomic data was compelling. In contrast with the AIS versus the invasive adenocarcinoma, and so then they talk about how they want to have this three-tiered modified classification, looking at, alveolar filling invasion and then the adenocarcinoma in situ, and essentially their take-home points is that we should have a modified classification that really stresses more about identifying these non-invasive in situ lesions, and that we're probably over-diagnosing invasion. And then they also do mention a small cohort of cases that were actually missed, right, in patients who in pathologists who didn't call invasion, and there actually was a little bit of invasion. So they touch on that a little bit. But the overall thrust of the paper that I think is actually backed for a large cohort of their patients by good data is that we're probably over-diagnosing invasion. Or over-diagnosing, yeah, over-diagnosing with invasion. And so, some of my thoughts on this paper, and I definitely want to throw it open to folks, is that I understand that, what we measure in invasion does dictate that clinical treatment. Since we disagree so poorly, is there a question that all the original clinical data based off of invasion versus not invasion, is that corresponding with what now they are talking about is invasion versus not invasion? So I'm not questioning that they're wrong, so to speak, quote unquote wrong, that maybe we are overdiagnosing what would be considered invasion. But if we were doing that with our original data sets, our clinical data sets, for all the clinical work that talks about AIS versus MIA and some of the original work done by Bill Travis, are we doing ourselves a disservice that we will only catch up to later? And so, of course, you have side effects and of adjuvant chemotherapy. I'm certainly not the expert in that, and we're not going to go into that. But the question then is, are we doing our patients a service by really trying to lower our T stages in these patients? And so, with that, I will throw this open to discussion. There are not a lot of people here.
Yeah, there's a lot in that paper, but I do agree with you on some of those pictures. I would not hesitate about micropapillary in some of those pictures. I think sometimes papillary and lipidic can definitely be hard. And then small foci of acinar invasion versus is this just continuation of lipidic is hard for me. But some of these are, I don't know, that looks pretty complex.
Yeah.
Yeah, I agree on those pictures as well. I'm a bit worried that they've misled a whole generation of pathologists looking at this.
Yeah, I mean, to put the criticism, it almost seems like they did a good job of training people to stop calling invasion. And so they got more concordance because they trained them that this is not invasion. But I'm not sure that it actually isn't. In some of the a few times they use terminology like it's generally supported by clinical outcomes. So it's not every case. Yeah. So they said that during the second round, there was a notable shift in the pathologist's assessments towards in situ adeno following using their modified classification after their training. And then they said this adjustment was generally justified by clinical follow-up data. So that bothers me because, then it comes into like a harm-benefit ratio, right? Are we causing more harm by missing a small cohort of patients by understaging them just so we can say we have less people with a lower stage?
I have to say, I wished I would know how to use the VVG stain correctly to look for adenocarcinoma in situ. I tried it a couple of times, but I never really saw a very, a continuous elastic stain in the interalveolar septa. It's more discontinuous, and then I never really knew how much discontinuity you can have and not. The other comment, so if someone has some great insight in that, I really would appreciate it. The other comment I would have with that paper, I mean, yeah, we may overcall now invasion, and I'm probably guilty of that too, But with that paper, we may undercall it. And then I would be very concerned about that as well if we would undercall invasion based on treatment.
So I use the elastic stain, and I think I have a lower, I have a higher threshold for invasion than my colleagues. I know that because we do reviews of each other's cases, and then we share cases, of course, as well. So I do like to use the elastic stain. I think, next time you get a case on, you let me know, and we can look at it together. And I'll at least
That
tell
would
you
be
how
great.
I do it. I mean, it's a little hard to
Thank you.
do it, in a meeting like this, but I do try to use it. I'm blanking on the Japanese guy who started all of this back in 95. But I've heard him talk a couple of times and share cases, and I think that has helped me to try to, use the elastic stain to a better advantage and to maybe not have as high a threshold or have a lower threshold for a higher threshold for invasion than some of my colleagues. So I would like to see the supplemental. I need to look at that. So I didn't see it in your Dropbox, Yasmin. So maybe you can add that.
It's a separate, it's like a, it's not a PDF, it's a Word file. So
But I
it
don't
should
see
be.
it in the Dropbox. That's all I'm saying. It's
Oh.
not under discussion or notation.
I did put it in there. I'll be sure to double check that after and make sure it's in there.
Thanks.
Henry, could you share the paper where, if you find it, about the elastic? I'd also like to know more about that.
Well, I don't know
How
that
to do
it,
it.
I mean, I don't know that I saw it in a paper. I've heard him
Okay.
speak, and he's the one who really got the AIS thing off the ground. I'm blanking on his name. It's not Dr. Kawabata, but you all know the name because it shows up in all the classifications for, AIS and so on. So,
Okay.
I mean, I can see if there's a paper. I can look around, but it's mostly by seeing him talk and kind of
Right.
walking through it.
And the use of P53 is also interesting. I have very little experience of P53 in lung cancers. We don't tend to use it very much.
Yeah, I see it sometimes in consult cases, and I always wonder how do you interpret it since I don't feel that there's a ton of data on it. But they did use this, and the same with Ki-67. Does anyone here use Ki-67 in evaluating if they're going to decide if something is in situ versus not in situ? I'll be honest, it never even
No.
occurred to me to do that. But they seem to try to
Yeah.
incorporate that into the data set here.
Hey, Jen, I noticed that you're on, and I notice you have an AI paper coming at being presented at USCAP on evaluation for invasion. So any thoughts on that and, how you trained the data set that how you trained the model and all that? She might be distracted.
It's embargoed.
I guess so. I guess so. Well, the
So,
abstract's published.
definitely, I think an interesting paper, and certainly something that we need to be aware of. And probably one of my big takeaways from this is that we really need to link ourselves to very concrete clinical outcome data. For how we handle these, because we often, I think, get maybe a little lost in the histology and what we're trying to call. And it's just important to know, like, is it actually going to change something for the patients? And are we going to miss a cohort of patients? And I don't know what the right answer is. Is it better to overdiagnose invasion a little bit and make sure that no one is missed? Or is it better to underdiagnose a little bit and not give unnecessary treatment to a small number of patients? So I think ultimately, I think that's actually the final clinical question, which I don't have an answer for, and I don't think any of us have an answer for right now.
Sorry, can
Jen,
you guys, can you hear
yeah,
me
now I can
now?
hear you.
Ah,
Yeah,
we can
Jen, we can hear
hear
you now.
you.
Okay.
Sorry about that.
Yeah,
My
Noguchi,
phone
you're
was
right,
being difficult.
Noguchi.
Yeah, I think Noguchi does have, he has some pictures in some of his older papers. They're in black and white. I don't know if that's going to be very helpful to, like, instructive as to how to use it. But anyway, so the AI model. So basically, we've tried to, I don't know, find a middle ground by having all six pathologists do the annotations for what we would consider invasion. We've tried to be a bit picky. I think that the currently the model for invasion is working, I think, better than the model for grading, if you will, or assigning a predominant pattern. A part of that is because we put more work into it, but it is, I mean, definitely when we're training the model to assess invasion, all of our biases probably get baked in there. So, I mean, eventually, when we have access to, unsupervised type of AI platforms, that might be maybe a better way to go, to just start from scratch and, funnel in patient outcomes and let the AI figure it out and see if it can do it better or differently than we do. But for now, we're essentially trying to be picky about what we annotate as invasion, but also, spreading it over basically six people's opinions. So hopefully what we're annotating represents some sort of middle ground.
That sounds really interesting. I'm looking forward to hearing about that. But I do like the comment too on like training the idea in the future of being able to kind of train backwards based off of patient outcomes, because then it feels like we're trying to get to the right endpoint, which is how is it actually going to respond? All right. So thank you, everyone. That was excellent discussion. So the next paper, I had this second because I was entertained by the fact that some of the photos in here might be disagreed with by the people who wrote the previous paper. So this one was looking at evaluating tumor budding as part of a potential new grading system for lung adenocarcinoma. And so, obviously tumor budding is very important in many other adenocarcinomas, including colorectal cancer, and as part of their templates to put that information in. So this one was trying to look at lung adenocarcinomas and tumor budding. And so they set up what they called a high-grade group and a low-grade group of tumor budding. So they considered low-grade 0 to 9 and 10, or and a high-grade greater than or equal to 10. And they looked at prognostic significance. They looked at a 5-year progression-free survival and overall survival, and actually did find one. So they looked at 100, let's see, 166 patients from 2011 to 2019 in their patient cohort. They did do non-mucinous adenocarcinoma, so they did mention that a challenge of assessing tumor budding in mucinous adenocarcinomas, and then they scored them based off of their system and essentially did their statistics. So, the paper is relatively straightforward, but I think highlighted by our previous paper, the challenges would be, what are they calling tumor budding? Assessing tumor budding, how many sections do you need to look at? And then your patterns, right, for tumor budding versus not. And I did want to show their photos because, I think here in this photo, which they called papillary, our previous authors might have called lipidic. I think that there are they did only assess tumor budding at the edges of the lesion. So again, if you have a disrupted specimen or if you're only looking at a biopsy, I think that introduces challenges. This was a single institution study, so it was not spread across multiple pathologists, multiple institutions. So I think that introduces a certain amount of biopsy or of a bias in what you're looking at, and they do recognize that. They only had one reader assessing their cases, but they did appear to come up with statistical significance in tumor budding versus not. It seems like they saw more tumor budding in solid and micropapillary, which you would expect. So then I guess the question would come into, is it just a factor that you're going to see more likely with these things and not an independent prognostic factor or not? So I think that's more of a statistical question than not. I do think there would be a lot of challenges in instituting this, but I'm curious if folks think about tumor budding. This is not the first article out there about tumor budding in lung, but I wonder about the actual reproducibility of something like this, because you're obviously not going to see something that's tumor budding with lipidic, just because of the nature of that pattern, versus not. So, is it additionally helpful? I guess is the question that I have after reading this paper. Also, interesting how we don't agree on patterns and. They're looking at clinical, just to tie the two together, even though they're not related, but they're looking at clinical outcomes that are fitting with what they're coming up with versus other paper looking at clinical outcomes that mostly fit with what they're coming up with. But then all the papers say we all disagree, but this is all based on patterns. So somehow we're doing okay, but even though we all disagree. So I just find that very interesting, and I do think this is a confusing topic. But curious to know what other folks think about the concept of tumor budding, and if you think this might become something that we do in the future.
We're adding yet another pattern that we can't
Feature.
even agree or feature. Well,
Yeah. Pattern
we can't
feature.
even agree, right? We can't even agree on the
Yeah.
ones that have already been put out there, let alone adding another one, which will just decrease reproducibility. But anyway.
Yeah, I just worry about the fundamental instability in our data collection because there's so much disagreement. Even in the papers where they're specifically trying to train people to agree, they still can't get 100% concordance.
Yeah.
We disagree, and our data is based off of those disagreements. So how do we have, cross-sectional comparisons of these data to put something together? So
And is this actually useful to the clinicians as well? Are they going to use it?
exactly. I don't know. I mean, to say that, tumor budding is increased in solid and micropapillary, that seems okay, that's reasonable. So that would make sense then. That would be, associated with worse disease-free progression. But you already have that data with the solid and papillary. So I'm
Right.
not sure if there's, any additional value in adding that, because then it creates another layer of a potential, I hate to say the word mistake, but maybe you call something tumor budding that's not, and it's not solid and micropapillary, and you've bumped them up and they think they have a worse prognosis than they do. And that probably oversimplifies it, but that's how my simple brain thinks about it. I'm like, I don't want to create more
No,
error in
I
our
agree.
reports. All
I agree.
right. I have a feeling this is not the last we're going to see tumor budding. So keep it on the radar. Decide what we want to do with that. All right. So, if no one has anything else, I want to move on to my, I think, of the second half of this. And I actually wanted to spend a little time talking about pediatric cases. So this is a review, and I know we don't normally do reviews, but I do think that it highlights a couple of different things that are coming out in the pediatric pediopath literature that we should be aware of. And I know certainly we see pediatric cases, although certainly in a smaller volume, but they do come up. So this was looking at so-called cystic masses in the pediatric lung and the current classification system, and proposes a different way that we might think about the classification of these lesions. So, we all know about the term congenital pulmonary airway malformation, which actually, kind of talks about a diverse groups of diseases ranging from ectopic lung to bronchial atresia, to mosaic oncogenic mutations, neoplasia. We see mucinous adenocarcinoma, things like that. So, I'm not going to spend too much time going over the existing classification, but we have our CPAM types and we have our sequestrations, and then if you want to go to the other, the Langston system, the small and large cysts, that's certainly there. So I just wanted to jump to the proposed sort of new type of classification because I thought it was helpful to think about things like this. So she grouped them by etiology. So the first one was a supernumerary airway and lung tissue. So either ranging from the supernumerary lung bud to the foregut duplication cysts, extralobar sequestrations, they would also put in this category. But she also moves those into the bronchial atresia-associated maldevelopment category. I think these are probably not as challenging to differentiate from some of the other features, and it makes sense to put them in their own group. She does make a point to talk about the bronchogenic cyst terminology has been used to talk about like kind of exclusively that supernumerary ectopic tissue, but then also maybe used in some other things, maybe in not quite as specifically like with CPAM type lesions, so that can be challenging. She talks about the Dicer-associated cystic lung disease. So rather than, and that obviously falls under those pleural pulmonary blastoma types, but I think referring to them as Dicer mutation-associated, talking about more of the underpinning, like driving mechanism of it, I think is helpful. And then she talks about the concept of the bronchial atresia-associated congenital cystic lung disease. So this is also a spectrum, but mostly falls under the Stalker type 2 and the Langston small cysts types. You can also see these in the intralobar and extralobar sequestrations. So she talks about the what we call some people call like the hybrid lesions, where you have CPAM plus sequestration, but it really kind of, she says it's really kind of falls under the bronchial atresia-associated congenital cystic lung disease. And then I think the most interesting part is lumping Stalker types 1 and 2 CPAM under this KRAS mosaic mutation-associated congenital pulmonary airway malformations. So rather than the sizes of the cysts, actually talking about those KRAS mutations. And this is why I wanted to highlight this paper, because I think this is something that I have been more aware of in the last couple of years. And I don't know if it's I'm aware of it, so I feel like I'm seeing it more. But the idea is that these type 1 and type 3 are KRAS driven. So this is sequestration here. So here's a talking about the KRAS mutations. And you have variability in the size of the cysts. So the idea of the back, sort of the quote unquote back to back cysts, even though they're not really true cysts, that's something she also points out, not true cysts, but that's okay. We're stuck with our terminology sometimes. And then the very large lesions that you see in the Stalker type 1. So this is her table that she has. And where's the table? Here it is. Right here, sorry. So hopefully people can see that. And then the KRAS mutations you see in the mucinous proliferations. And one topic that she talks about here, which I think is, I don't know if disconnect is the right word, but something that's challenging between the pediatric literature and when these patients make it to adulthood and they end up getting their CPAM or KRAS driven mutated CPAM lesions resected, is do you call something mucinous adenocarcinoma or do you not, right? So I think that terminology is different depending on how you approach these cases and honestly the age of the patient. And I'm curious to know how other folks are approaching this, especially Jen. I wanted to get your thoughts on this, how you approach these cases, because in the adult population, if we have, mucinous tufts in a biopsy in a patient with, ground glass opacity or lobar consolidation, that's mucinous adenocarcinoma. And I don't think any of us would feel uncomfortable calling that. However, in the context of an airway malformation and maybe someone who's 20 or 30 or 40 even, and you have mucinous proliferations, do you apply the same morphologic criteria? And then even using that KRAS mutation is not necessarily helpful, because there's data also put out by this group showing that you have those KRAS mutations in the background non-mucinous lung tissue that is part of that CPAM lesion. So clearly it's part of the driver for these congenital mutations. And obviously there are a small cohort of patients who don't have resections of these cases, but do end up with metastatic mucinous adenocarcinoma in the future. Thankfully, it's a very small number, but it does happen. So clearly there is something where you do have cancer. It's not that none of these are cancer, but I think this paper and this proposed classification highlights the importance of recognizing the differences when you see mucinous, this mucinous metaplasia slash evolving into mucinous adenocarcinoma in a CPAM context versus in a non-CPAM context. So just wanted to throw that out to discussion.
So I can start, I guess. So I mean, I think we don't see a lot of those, query mucinous adenocarcinoma cases here. And listening to Jenny and Gail and Megan and other people that know a lot more about pediatric pulm path than I do, it does seem to crux a lot on the age of the patient, the significance of that mucinous epithelium. So if I'm understanding what they're saying correctly, they tolerate essentially anything if the child is an infant.
A
They
lot,
will
basically.
yeah they will essentially not call it mucinous adenocarcinoma if it's an infant. And then if the child is older, the threshold kind of comes crashing down fairly quickly, if you're talking about a 7 or 8 year old kiddo. I have to say, I don't see see a lot these days. I'm not seeing a lot of resected CPAMs in anyone other than infants. I mean, I think the standard of care obviously is to remove them, and most people are getting prenatal ultrasounds, and most of the time they know these are there, and the kiddo will get a lobectomy, before their second birthday. I think it is interesting this I don't know. I don't know how to feel about all of these, adult patients where people are like, "Oh, I think this is a CPAM." Honestly, I think most of those cases aren't a CPAM at all, and they probably had a necrotizing pneumonia in that lobe and ha end up with cysts and remodeling, and or they have bronchiectasis or something else. Most of the cases that in adults that get sent to me as query CPAM, I don't. If they're a CPAM, I can't recognize them as such anymore. And I suppose one could argue, well, after 20, 30 years of remodeling, are you sure you can recognize it? And I guess my answer would be, no, I'm not sure about that. But if I had an adult patient and I was seeing, extensive mucinous proliferation, I would call it mucinous adenocarcinoma, because I don't think that the chances of me seeing a pristine CPAM in an adult patient with mucinous metaplasia is just so low that I would want them to be followed extremely carefully. And I feel like if it's, the margin's negative and the lymph nodes are negative, probably the most conservative thing to do is to call it cancer and hope that they get the follow-up that they need. I don't think, hopefully they wouldn't get chemo or anything, but they would get cancer follow-up, which I think is what they need.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, and I wonder too, I mean, and this is about the utility in these patients that have, older patients who may or may not have a previously undiagnosed CPAM is running molecular on the background tissue of the supposed CPAM, right? And if you see a KRAS mutation in that background tissue, similar to what you would see in a kiddo with a CPAM. But certainly an interesting topic, and I feel like we get maybe one or two cases a year like this, where we there wonder again, query CPAM, and then you see mucinous adeno, and it's like a 20-something-year-old, and you're like, well, could be, how do you approach it? And they may have a better prognosis than someone with just a de novo, so to speak, mucinous adeno, and a non-smoker. Definitely an interesting topic, and I agree, we don't see these as much as I would like to get comfortable with them. But I apologize for any pediatric folks listening if I butchered this beautiful summary. But just to put it in everyone's minds, in case you have one of these rare birds in a slightly younger but not pediatric patient run across your desk, I think it's a definitely a really nice article. All right. So last but certainly not least, we have Andy Cherg's article looking at the pathologic features of connective tissue disease associated ILD, so CTD-ILD, in transbronchial biopsies. And looks like the good Dr. Taslar is also on this paper. So Henry, you could jump in if I say anything incorrectly on this. I thought this was a very nice paper looking at CTD-ILD in transbronch biopsies. And so as a, it's I think relatively straightforward in the sense that they took a bunch of transbronchial biopsies and cryobiopsies, and they looked to see how well they served to differentiate between different entities. So the CTD-ILD, whether or not the patient had UIP and then possibly IPF, chronic hypersensitivity pneumonitis. So let me pull my thing up. Let's see. Go to the pictures here. And I think the results were essentially what I would have expected. Let's see, where's my thing here? All right. So it seemed that in the current context, so if you have on the cryo NSIP plus OP, that would certainly favor a CTD-ILD. So they correlated all of this with MDD diagnoses, right? So in some way, it's a retrospective looking back at MDD diagnosis, say, okay, they did decide they had a CTD-ILD. Do we feel like on the cryo that they did? So if the patient's pattern was NSIP plus organizing pneumonia, that would favor a CTD-ILD in cryo. However, if it was a CTD-ILD that had a UIP pattern, or if it was a fibrotic HP with a UIP pattern, and the patient ended up having being diagnosed with IPF, that generally that just that. That discrimination was challenging on cryobiopsies. So I think that And that's kind of the nutshell summary of this, but I think that makes a lot of sense based off of what we know we can get from a cryobiopsy for other things as well. So it depends on the overall pattern of what that CTD is. You still, I think, have to bring in your MDD diagnosis. Again, the NSIP plus OP is useful, but challenging on cryos, of course, to diagnose a UIP pattern. It's not that you can't, but it's a little bit harder. And then if you had a fibrotic HP with a UIP pattern, I think that's also challenging. So, but I think a nice paper going through the morphologic categories and what you can have a stronger kind of confidence on diagnosing versus not. So I don't know, Henry, if you wanted to add anything else or make any other comments on this, but I just thought it was a nice paper
You know, I
highlighting.
think thanks, Yasmin. I think the issue of lymphoid hyperplasia is a little bit confusing. So the problem is we didn't see it that often. And so when we did see it, if you saw, some of it, more of it than like one, and I'm just kind of throwing that out there, it might favor a CTD, but it just you didn't see it very often. And we know that we can see it in IPF. So we're just not looking at very much tissue. And I think that's the problem of the lymphoid hyperplasia, which we all like to use to point us towards a CTD. The other thing I will say is we just sent in a letter last week looking at levels in cryobiopsies. So in our consult practice, we frequently get one level or two, and I don't know how many you all are doing, but our paper suggests, so it's a letter to the editor. Pete was the first author, so he can comment as well, but that if you should probably start with 5 H&Es, and if you don't see specific features, including fibroblast foci, giant cells, granulomas, and you see a background of fibrosis that looks either like UIP or NSIP, get 10 levels. After, we got up to 9, we got up to 10 and we got more information. Now, could we do 20? I suppose, but we stopped at 10. But the point is, you got to do more than one. So I don't know how many people are doing, but anyway, we'll see whether that gets accepted for publication. But anyway, that's our anecdotal, less than anecdotal, because we went through our cases, did more levels, looked for more stuff. So
So
that's
Henry has a
equally as
good.
important as this paper.
Was just going to ask, so by levels, you're doing real levels, not serial sections.
Correct.
I
And
guess.
we'll do two and then skip two. We'll do a cut, skip two cuts, do a level, skip two cuts, then do two unstained to keep those for stains, and then do three more level, two cuts, throw away, section, two cuts, throw away, section.
Okay, because we always do multiple serial sections in transbronchial and often bronchial biopsies here, and they did show that you need a certain number of levels or serial sections to find sarcoid granulomas as well.
Yeah, it's
So that
based on
makes
that kind
sense.
of data, right? We quote those papers exactly, but nobody's done that for cryobiopsies.
Right. And there's a lot of tissue there, so I guess levels are fine
Exactly,
with that.
exactly. Yeah.
And then I
That's
just wanted to
right.
understand. Oh, sorry.
No, please go ahead.
I had another question. So, because we did a similar sort of study here with a Canadian group, and we didn't have the greatest correlation of cryobiopsies with wedges. So, was this compared to wedges?
No.
Okay.
No, it wasn't.
No.
I mean, I think it highlights what. In data form, what we kind of logically understand, like you see less. So if you have features, if you have better features, it can be seen on something that's not, getting the pleura and getting out to the periphery, then you can support something in the appropriate context. But if you don't, you can't, right? So I think it's just further supportive of what probably we all feel about cryobiopsies, like helpful when they're helpful, but not always.
I'm also wondering if we need to look into which cryoprobe they actually use, because there are various sizes out there. And I'm wondering, and I didn't find it here in the method, which size was used, but maybe it's somewhere else in the paper. I don't
No, I
remember
don't
the
think
size of the
we th these are the
probe.
I,
It
this is
was
the
just,
bigger probe. It's
it's the
not the
biopsy
probe.
area they gave.
Yeah, no, it's the probe size. It's like a 2.4, 1.9, and now they
It's
also
the
have a 1.1.
These were the bigger probes, not for tumor, but you raise a good point, Anya. Thanks. That wasn't in here, and these were for multiple institutions. So,
Not a lot
I
of,
suppose there's,
yeah.
I mean, that's an average size piece that
Yeah.
is that figure one there.
You know, I'm wondering if they should get a recommend, if there should be some guidelines or recommendations on which kind of probe they need to at least use for if they think about an interstitial lung disease versus tumor and these kind of things.
That can be the next paper looking at probe sizes.
Yeah.
Well, there might be, I'll bet there's clinical guidelines on that. I don't, we're the receiving end, of course, right?
Yeah.
So, and I don't know. We'll have to look at that.
All right.
But I
Well,
think whatever size probe you get, it's better than an ordinary transbronch.
that's
And
right.
you still need to do multiple levels, right? Which, isn't always happening in the community, at least.
Yeah, and there's
That is
another
totally
article
cool.
in there's another article in Notation talking about using cryos to diagnose mesotheliomas, which I thought was kind of interesting, and they actually were able to do that in many of their cases. So a couple of interesting articles in Notation. I know we're pretty much done. A nice review talking about large cell basaloid adenocarcinoma of the lung as a mimic of large cell neuroendocrine carcinoma. Definitely recommend taking a look at that. On the non-neoplastic side, I wanted to highlight that BAL fluid cellular analysis is not that helpful with fibrotic lung disease, which I think is probably not a surprise, but it was nice to actually see that. There's a nice case report on exogenous lipoid pneumonia in someone who was had an eating disorder and was eating large amounts of like oily salad dressing and vomiting it up. So always interested in the next thing that causes exogenous lipoid pneumonia. And then a couple of dueling articles. They're very clinical, talking about, pathologic complete response for neoadjuvant and should you get neoadjuvant chemo. And I put them on there more just to highlight the importance of should we, how important assessing for pathologic complete response is because it really does affect the treatment of the patients. And I know we're seeing starting to see more of those cases. All right, so sorry to go 2 minutes over. Thank you, everyone. Appreciate your engagement.
Thank you. That was wonderful.
Thank you very
Yeah,
much.
thanks.
Thank you.